Ryan Reynolds here from Mint Mobile.
With the price of just about everything going up during inflation, we thought we'd bring our prices down. So to help us, we brought in a reverse auctioneer, which is apparently a thing.
Mint Mobile Unlimited Premium Wireless. I bet you get 30, 30, I bet you get 30, I bet you get 20, 20, 20, I bet you get 20, 20, I bet you get 15, 15, 15, 15, just $15 a month, sold.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello and welcome to The Back Half with me, Tom.
And me, Kate.
We're back from our extended summer break.
Our sabbaticals.
Our 10 weeks on Lilo's.
I was in a treehouse.
Were you?
Mm.
What were you doing in the treehouse?
So it was a treehouse that was built by an architect who'd obviously wanted to do it since he was a child, and his wife had allowed him to build this treehouse in the garden as long as he put it on Airbnb. So it's quite new and it's in Austria. And it's giant. It's like four pine trees that he's adapted into a treehouse with all the mod cons, like DVD players and toilets.
So does it sit in between four trees?
Yes. It's balanced on four trees, but it's got like two bedrooms, two sun decks, and then loads of hammocks underneath it. And a big nest of hornets.
In the house?
In the trees. But they don't bother you because They're kind of happy because they've got tree to go in. So actually you're kind of very close to what could sting you, but it doesn't come in. It's really great. What about you?
I was mainly driving around the west of Ireland listening to songs from Trolls the movie with my kids, which was fun.
What are the songs of Trolls the movie?
You're like? Kidding.
Yeah, I don't know.
Funnily enough, Ariana Grande's on there.
Which song?
Which we were going to talk about later. It's
just a noise.
I'm not sure. It's just Trolls music. Who else is on there? Justin Timberlake's on there. Mm-hmm. They do this thing. I don't know whether this is, I guess this is a thing with kids' movies, and I suppose I'm aware of it from Shrek and things like that. Like, do you remember at the end of Shrek, they do the monkeys, I'm a Believer.
Mm.
So it's kind of covers, sort of odd covers of things done with the voice of Poppy the Troll.
Mm.
Yeah.
Classic tunes sung by trolls.
Yeah.
But yes, we are returning to Ariana Grande later in our programme. And we're also going to be talking about ITV's great, now in its third season, detective series Unforgotten.
And we'll have a non-anniversary.
Going back a few years, something important that happened that we thought was interesting.
From our past. Let's push on. So, Kate, you turned me on to Unforgotten, which has just finished its third season on ITV. Tell me a bit about it. Tell me what's the setup? Mm. What's the premise?
So what makes it distinctive is that it's about historical murder cases.
Right.
It's a woman cop and a man cop, Nicola Walker and Sanjeev Bhaskar.
That's fairly standard, right?
Yeah. Who investigate a skeleton. So every season starts with a skeleton being unearthed somewhere. And within the first 15 to 20 minutes, we're told by a great forensic woman in a kind of like very forensic outfit, maybe with a bit of high vis or whatever. She's like dusting down some bones. And everyone's standing around it going, oh, it could be Roman. There's an old Roman site there. And she goes, aha, no, you'll see here that there is a fracture that's been mended with a particular kind of metal that came in 1977. So I would date this skeleton to, you know, whatever.
You'll see here that they're holding a packet of fags.
Yeah, exactly. You'll see here that they have an Oasis CD in their back pocket. I think this is from 1995. And that's all you need. And then we begin to investigate the identity of the skeleton, which we then find out fairly quickly. But the amazing thing about this show is that it very quickly uncovers a kind of lattice work of people working in all sorts of different walks of life, areas of their careers, ages, middle-aged and elderly people who are somehow all connected to this skeleton that's been found. And then we spend 5 or 6 hours unpicking this increasingly large web to reveal how on earth the person died. And you can't, I mean, it's very, very hard to predict the storylines, I think. I watched it from the first season when Tom Courtney was the standout. There's usually one standout actor in it. And it's very difficult to remember who actually did the murder when you look back a couple of years after seeing the seasons. And yeah, he got BAFTA for that award. And in the latest season, it's kind of Alex Jennings is one of the standout actors, but pretty good. What did you think?
Well, I've only seen the third season, but I loved it. I wanted to ask you, though, it's a minor question, but is the skeleton always discovered by accident, or are they ever looking for...
No, it's always by accident.
It's always by accident.
And I don't know whether... I mean, I should know this, really, being interested in this programme, but I don't know whether there are departments that are dedicated solely to looking into historic cases, or whether they are generally detectives who are also looking at...
That's the
current
one. That's one. I mean, it's slightly jumping ahead, but that's one of the possibly less convincing things. But we need to check.
Yeah.
We need an expert to write in and tell us, really.
Because by the sound of it, these two guys have been
so
on.
So we don't have to do any research. But they've got a whole team, haven't they? And they're just working on this one cold case.
Yeah.
So you kind of feel in austerity Britain that that might not be. Okay, admittedly, this one is an important case because it was a case that was very well publicised because it's a missing girl.
Mm.
But still, you kind of feel that sort of half a dozen people in an office all
yes.
kind of working.
It's
round
one of
the
beauties of
one.
the dramatic representation
yeah.
of the.
They're not having to like follow up on other things or do admin in between.
And also, there are the cliches of them being sort of almost overly involved in the family of the what turns out to be a missing girl who went missing 18 years ago. So yeah, in terms of their emotional connections to these cases, they wouldn't be really supportable, and they wouldn't be able to kind of get any work done if they were this involved. But just in brief, it's a story of an 18-year-old case of a teenage girl who went missing around New Year at the millennium. So it's quite an evocative, you know, we all know where we were at the millennium, and we were all having either brilliant times or crap times. And at the centre of the investigation are four middle-aged men who have been friends since school. And I found this a first in terms of, you know, we're trained now to look out for the idea of, you know, character diversity, multicultural
yeah.
Britain and everything. And
just
I thought,
four white dudes.
I just thought, oh my God, it's just four white guys. Like, is this what we're going to get? And then the beauty of it to me was that these were the great white males in decline. You
yeah.
know,
it's yeah,
just the kind of
true.
Our Grace and Perry guest edit, the idea of this suffering race of powerful men who are losing their grips on power in middle age. They have astonishingly bad mental health. they live in systems of lies that they have convinced themselves are true. There's
yeah.
a great Peter Carr is one of the characters played by Neil Morrissey, and all these men come under suspicion for this murder because they were all in the same holiday cottage at the same time. So it's a great idea. And at one point, Peter Carr's wife says to him, you know, I genuinely think that if you had committed this murder, you would be able to convince yourself that you hadn't. And this sense of people who've been living in self-belief, insecurity, and living within fictions of their own making for 20 years or so. And I think it's like, that's sort of what it was looking at. And then the peripheral satellite characters are actually, I mean, there weren't any sort of bad women or non-white characters in it, were there? They were all the kind of the ones who had the moral
high ground
on the outside. And then you had these guys in the middle who had just completely fucked up their lives and it was all falling apart.
It's a great quartet. I mean, it's a brilliant cast. Nicola Walker and Sanjeev Bhaskar are terrific, I think. And the four you mentioned, Neil Morrissey as Peter Carr, Alex Jennings plays a doctor, Tim Finch, James Fleet, who's the bumbling guy from Four Weddings and a Funeral and Vicar of Dibley, he's in as well, plays Chris Lowe, who's this kind of, who's the one whose life has sort of unraveled, perhaps most obviously. Mm. He's living in a camper van and painting, and keeps all his sort of cash in a metal box. And I'm missing one, aren't I? Oh, James, there's a character, James Hollis, who's a sort of John Humphreys type character, isn't he? He's a sort of media celebrity. He hosts a quiz show, but in a very sort of serious John Humphreys way.
Yeah.
And that's Kevin McNally, who seemed familiar to me, but I couldn't tell you what he's done.
They just looked the part so well,
totally,
didn't they?
They're
casting it. The other thing about it, I think, is extremely understated program in some ways, and you can see the acting that you get from Nicola Walker and Sanjeev Bhaskar also carries into, I thought, in the character of Alex Jennings, who plays the Dr. Tim Finch, was that they're almost slightly embarrassed by being on screen in the best possible way. It feels a very sort of British understated sort of presentation they do. So Nicola Walker will get these lines, which you would get in any American sort of detective show, like, let's find this killer and give the family the peace that they deserve and stuff like that. But she says everything, like looking down into her cardigan, almost smiling, like she's embarrassed by everything, mumbling.
Yeah.
And Sanjeev Bhaskar has a kind of a backstory that's been going through all the seasons, where he sort of at some point was very attracted to her romantically. That both their kind of home lives were slightly on shaky ground. And now he's got a lot of affection for her, but he's sort of almost embarrassed by that cliche as well. Like it's like Sarge this, Sarge that, and he does care for her, but it's sort of like, oh god, it's a bit cringy. And then in the Alex Jennings character, who is he's like the masterpiece of this program, really. He plays the sort of village doctor, whose ability to show compassion to his patients and to listen to them is also done in an incredibly understated way. What did you think of his, like, was he effective for you as a doctor? Like, did you believe him?
Yeah, I mean, the character development for all four is very good, in that you're in a very classic way, you're kind of presented with what seems a fully formed character, and then as the episodes go on, they're all sort of unpicked and unraveled. So the Jennings character, you learn that there's a sort of malpractice case against him, but the woman making the case is totally discredited. He's such an upstanding member of the community. He seems very sort of, you see him in all sorts of situations having very genuine, kind, you know, going the extra mile for his patients and his friends. And then there's a great scene where he just sends back a bottle of wine in a restaurant because it's corked.
Oh yeah.
It's just a brilliant insight into what could be, you know, another side to its character. It's corked. You don't need to check. I've told you.
Yeah.
It's corked.
That was
that was one of watching this with my wife Claire over the last few days. It's corked became one of their sort of catchphrases.
One of the most passag things you can say to each other.
The others being great work, Fran. There's one of the sort of DCs on the case is this woman Fran who just sort of disappears for a few hours and then comes back with an amazing thing she's worked out. So I like one spin-off series, I think, is the adventures of Fran.
The Adventures of Fran.
But I thought Jennings was brilliant. And just to go back to what you're saying about Nicola Walker, who is very distinctive, has a very distinctive style anyway.
Very odd style, I think.
Yeah, I mean, she is brilliant. What else have we seen her in? She's done a lot of stage work. She's in Last Tango in Halifax. It's this amazing sort of half broken smile that she has, which is totally unique to her, I think. And I think she does it very effectively. When we're watching those scenes that you're just talking about, where she's kind of summing things up to her team, or giving them instructions. Again, Claire, who's a teacher, is like, she's really bad at presenting. You know, she can't stand up in front of a group of people. And Again, I just kept wanting her to say, let's roll or something like
exactly.
that.
And there's this great subplot going on with a very strange relationship with her dad. So yes. again, we've got the cliche of the detective who's got the crap home life.
Yeah.
And, you know, she can't get a relationship going. She's sitting drinking a glass of red wine every night. And isn't. And Rachel Cook, our TV critic, gets like continually knocked.
I was going to mention
this.
Rachel, actually, because Rachel's thing is, why can't they just be doing a really good job and sort of be
yes,
stable and
specifically
happy with that.
Women yeah. policemen and women yeah. detectives. They yeah. always and so he does fall into the writer does fall into that yeah. cliche with this. But the interesting twist on it is that she lives with her father,
yeah.
who she convinces herself is getting Alzheimer's because she's actually jealous that he's got a new girlfriend. And whenever she's with him, the dynamic is teenage girl and dad, and it's just amazingly done. Like as soon as she goes back into that door, she's a sulky. Can't look him in the eye, rejecting him when he tries to give her a cuddle and all that kind of thing. I was just thinking about Jennings as well and the sort of sense that I also got with him in the sort of soft-spoken, almost non-acting that he does.
And yeah.
Full of pauses and the way he sort of looks down at his chest when he talks as well. And I don't know how he researched this, but there are two scenes where you see his kindness, his sort of what we then discover is a kind of learned kindness, one of which when he goes to a patient who's lost his elderly wife and the other one when he goes to visit his school friend who's now living in a camper van. And I was just thinking like what he's doing with them, that he's sort of fully engaged with them. He's very reassuring, very unpressurizing. He tells them that what they're feeling is completely natural. He gives them a few options and offers to help. He reassures them that he's there, and then they don't have to do anything they don't want to do. And so you get these like little vignettes of like, this is one of the most amazing supportive characters in this in this show. And then obviously we're not going to give any spoilers, but the fronts that these guys are putting on are kind of dropped as it progresses.
It is well written, isn't it? Chris Lang is the writer, and it's just very unshowy in the writing and in the filming style. Actually, I was thinking about other things like Collateral, the David Hare recent sort of crime drama, which was all very kind of gritty and stylish in the filming. Or even, you know, you have none of that here. You have none of the sort of epic landscape shots of. You have a little bit of that, but not much of that kind of epic landscape shots of Happy Valley. It's just very straightforward storytelling, unfussy, but well done. And I think in some ways even done more effectively than things like Jack Thorne's Kiri, which we both liked, I think. Some people were very critical of that.
But that was very stylized in its dialogue.
And it kind of stepped into staginess, didn't it? And there are a few stagey moments in this. But one thing it shares with that, and I wanted to see what you thought of this, is how well do you think it, they've definitely tried to put in some social issues into this.
I thought they were quite clunky. There's a terrible character who's a sort of sensationalist blogger who is a quite key part of the plot because she gets online every 2 minutes and writes horrible things about a guy who's under suspicion but hasn't actually done anything, and then this results in a terrible outcome. And it's effective at first when you see that they're covering the old nasty blogging journalism side of what we're living in at the moment. But when she's hauled into a police station and she breaks down and goes, I only wanted a paid job. I've got a degree in journalism, and I've never earned a penny for my words. You're like, okay, did you really have to shoehorn like that in as well? And then also, the TV host, I can't remember his name, our John Humphreys type character.
James Hollis.
He has a son who has been affected by this historical crime and is, I think, using heroin or whatever. But he's also experimenting with lipstick and being kind of trans at the same time. And there's a kind of strange, undeliberate connection there made between the idea of somebody who's kind of going off the rails and doesn't know who they are and might also be experimenting with that side of their life. And I just thought that was a little bit heavy-handed.
I thought also that's quite, you know, far be it from us to judge, but that's a bit un-PC.
Exactly.
You know, I think, you know, the trans community might, you know,
yeah.
get a bit upset.
Oh, he doesn't, Elliot doesn't know who he is. That's why he's wearing lipstick.
Yeah.
And it's like, I don't think so.
And then you've got a bit of flick of Me Too as well, because James Hollis's ex-wife sort of goes on the radio and talks about kind of destructive relationships.
She's like on Woman's Hour or something.
Like, and kind of lack of consent in sexual relationships and things. I mean, particularly the blogger, but that was all a bit shoehorned in. Funny, just thinking about Jack Thorne's work, the sort of John Humphreys type character did make me think a bit about National Treasure and how good that was. Robbie Coltrane playing this TV comedian.
Yeah.
Some of that same, you know, weird self-assurance and kind of, you then don't know, okay, are these guys just really self-confident and everyone's always said yes to them and they're powerful and a bit egotistical, but that's it. Mm. Or are they also willing to kind of abuse that power to an extent that is actually really
and
disturbing?
To what extent do they believe their own fictions that they've told themselves about their careers and their lives and their own sort of innocence? And I think National Treasure does it even better. Like you're left really not knowing what the story is at the end of that. Whereas this, it has to resolve who did this crime.
But I
did think it was a nice muted ending in a sense, because the person that we discover is responsible, we actually discover 5 hours in, and there's a whole other hour afterwards. Not in some kind of like complicated court case situation of finding out why he did it, but just letting it unfold and letting you sit with him for a while and kind of appreciate something that actually wasn't that much of a surprise to you narratively, like you kind of knew it in the beginning.
That was really nicely done. Just on a side note on the Jack Thorne stuff, I spotted that he's making I didn't realize, but National Treasure and Kiri are part of a loose trilogy.
Ooh.
And he's making a third one. But I think National Treasure was so much better than Kiri, and it seems like now the emphasis is going to be on sort of issues. So
yeah.
I'm not sure.
Yeah.
How well
they're talking about a fourth
they're
season.
They're
going to
do another one,
well.
Aren't they? Yeah.
But I hope it doesn't go too issue based and too sort of. It did go a bit American in the last episode, I thought, with the sort of
a lot of swelling music,
aerial
and,
shots, and them going to deliver flowers to the grave of the murdered girl. Like they're that invested in each case, and she would have had meltdown years ago if she was visiting the family of every case that she'd worked on. The writer is Chris Lang, who was the drummer in the House Martins.
Oh yes,
in the 1980s, in a similar era to when Norman Cook was the bass player in the House Martins, which I did not know.
Do you think they're still in touch? Do you think they like the four members of the four suspects in this meet up for regular dinners?
Yes, love your mates. And they go to they'll book something on, you know, one of those restaurant apps and turn up and catch up every now and again. But
I was thinking about this because I meet up with my male friends from school every so often for dinner. And you, until the very end, actually, and I won't say what happens because we're trying to avoid spoilers in this, but you... They're constantly trying to arrange to catch up, and then they never do until sort of, I think it's the last or the penultimate episode, and it's fairly bleak. Hopefully none of them are going to end up.
Maybe the House Martins was a great springboard for future careers, the way, you know, your school was.
What are the others doing?
Yeah, well.
They Heaton, need to pull their socks off.
Heaton's done stuff. So I don't know who the other ones were. Apparently it was a revolving door of musicians, a bit like The Fall. I wonder why that was.
So Unforgotten, all three series, I think you can watch them on ITV Player or Amazon.
Yeah.
A combination.
You can watch them in one go.
Yeah.
I don't remember anything about the second season at
really?
All.
Is that,
first
is
one
that
great,
the weak,
third
is
one
that
great.
The weak one?
Well, I don't know.
Okay.
Maybe I was
sounds
just
like it. Sounds like it might be. So maybe one and three.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Burrow's furniture is built for the way you live. From ensuring easy assembly and disassembly to honoring highly requested new colors for their award-winning seating, they always have their customers in mind. Their modular seating is made out of durable materials to last and grow with you. And with Burrow, you always get fast, free shipping. Get up to 60% off during Burrow's Memorial Day sale at burrow.com/ACAST. That's burrow.com/ACAST. burrow.com/ACAST.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit betterhelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
So, Kate, I'm ashamed to say that until the horrible bombing in Manchester last year, May 2017, I was completely unaware of Ariana Grande, despite the fact that she was already a massive global pop sensation.
Mm.
You did know about her.
I did a bit. I was kind of curious. She is 25 now. So when the bombing happened, she was 23. She is from Italian, New York background. Her mother, I like this kind of information, her mother was chief executive for a firm that does telecommunications for shipping. And they moved down to Florida to a place called, I read it as Boca Raton, which is the suburbs of Miami, but it's probably pronounced Boca Raton or something like that. And she sort of did community school theater in Fort Lauderdale and that kind of area, so she's a very Florida girl, and she got into I think she was performing on cruise ships by the time she was 8 years old. It is the world of cruise ships down there. And she did Nickelodeon shows, so she became a child star, but she was always more interested in music because she had kind of musical theater ability to imitate different different kinds of voices. And if you've ever YouTubed her, you can see her doing Judy Garland in jazz clubs. And you can also see this very famous clip on the Jimmy Fallon show where they have a song generator where they spin a kind of little funny wheel and it comes up with a sing in the style of, and then you do the song. So the famous one with her was that she did The Wheels on the Bus in the style of Christina Aguilera, which she did pretty effortlessly. And yeah, so she obviously entered the consciousness in a very, of the kind of like, a lot of people in a very horrific way last May. And this is her first album since then. So this is her album called Sweetener.
And I read that it has shattered the Spotify record for the most streamed album by a female artist in its first week.
Wow, really?
Yeah. I don't know how many, is it her sort of fourth record something, maybe?
Something like that.
and she seems to have kind of trodden a sort of fairly well charted path in terms of like kind of quite cutesy bubblegummy, and then through to, I think her last record was all I'm a Woman, you know, a bit risque,
bit of alter egos and bunny ears and negligees and things like that.
And now she's sort of doing something for herself. She's done more writing on this record than on her previous ones. And it's I really enjoyed it. It's an odd record. It's not. I mean, you read a review that said something about it having a lot of bangers, which
it's banger free.
It doesn't seem to have a lot of bangers at all. I mean, it's got some good pop songs on it, but it's quite understated in its bangerness. And there's not loads of. I think when she first came out, there was she was. Her vocals were compared a lot to Mariah Carey and that kind of style. And that seems to have more or less gone. So there's not lots of double-tracked soaring vocals.
I think the voice is really unusual, and I didn't really know how good her voice was until the One Love concert in Manchester that was obviously very quickly organised after the bombing. She's got a sort of very soft, mellifluous, kind of bubbly, fizzy voice that kind of dances around the music. And when she was on stage in Manchester,
it was just a masterpiece of restraint, really. Mm. You know, she's standing there in this famously now in this kind of white sweatshirt with her hair back. And it's almost like she was supporting everybody on the stage. She was kind of there working in the background, even though she might have been doing the lead vocal on one of the songs. And her voice kind of like bubbled and floated over the music. And there was none of the chest beating that the entire generation of people who are into her have been raised on. There isn't that hardness that you get with Mariah Carey's kind of melismas and that kind of thing. Or in that more sort of, I don't know, post X Factor and America's Got Talent kind of lung-busting sort of singing. It's not like that at all. And I think that the way these songs are constructed, like, yeah, they are quite sort of, it is quite banger-free. They don't have big choruses and things. A lot of them were co-written with Pharrell Williams. And it's not a particularly accessible record in a funny
kind of way. Not on the first listen, no.
No, which is weird to think that a lot of the people listening to this are 10 years old. Mm. And so without them even asking to be, they're being introduced to some quite complex song structures and complex production, and they're just like, yeah, we love Ariana, so we're just going to do this.
Yeah, which is great. Yeah, I mean, there's one track on there particularly which is produced by Pharrell Williams, and if I was prepared, I'd tell you what it was called, something like The Light Is Coming. And it's a kind of really stripped back like hip-hop structure. It's Nicki Minaj has the guest slot, but the guest slot comes like right at the beginning. There's a sample which I looked up is a constituent shouting at some senator in 2009. Oh, yeah. sort of, and then Ariana's sort of chorus is sort of semi-spoken as well. And yes, it's a kind of you would have thought it would be a bit of a curveball to the 10-year-old listener, but I suppose it's of a piece with the way in which that kind of, I guess it's that it is kind of the more indie side of hip hop and R&B, the sort of Frank Ocean type stuff is leaching into into mainstream pop.
Yeah, there's quite a lot of Drake on it as well, I think.
Yes, yeah. And I saw, you know, Tyler, the creator from Odd Futures, tweeting, like, this is my favourite song right now. It wasn't that one, but it was another one on there. Mm. And, you know, I mean, I don't know how these worlds overlap, but he's someone, I mean, certainly when they came out, you'd associate him with quite extreme, like anti-mainstream, quite shocking. So it's kind of interesting that those are blurring together now.
When I interviewed Jack White last year, and he was saying that by far and away the most interesting production these days is being done in hip hop. And that's where you get the real use of space and of impressionistic kind of effects, really. And that also ties in with the fashion for the visual album. So when these things are kind of, I don't know if it's true in her case, but when these things in Beyoncé's case are conceived as being like films, then you do have sort of scene changes within the films, which the music then has to kind of back up. So it's almost like going backwards or something. The other thing I thought was interesting about it, I don't know how long these discussions must have been for what she was going to do with her new record, but I imagine an awful lot of thought went into how much she's going to acknowledge the traumatic events or not. But it's quite a bold, positive thing for your first single after that to be called No Tears Left to Cry.
Mm.
Because if you just saw that title, you might think it was going to be a kind of rousing sort of stadium stomper, like, hey, we're all in it together. But there's something about it which is kind of able to, it feels like the album's moving on a bit from what happens. Even the fact that it's called Sweetener, and then there's the last track on it is called Get Well Soon, which is full of these kind of creamy harmonies and has this sort of Janet Jackson meets Drake sort of feel. But yeah, there isn't any sort of real getting into the nitty-gritty of what happened. No Tears Left to Cry was, I think, co-written with Max Martin, and that's the one that has the closest melodic structure to the big hit that she had that was released after Manchester.
Right.
So yeah, that's kind of the minor key, the sad song, but it's still quite a bold title, I think.
Yeah, and to allow that stuff to kind of inform the writing of it without sort of hitting it on the nose is a kind of more creatively smart and interesting way to approach it, I think, probably. She's funny, like, I was looking her up on Twitter. It's still, you know, okay, this is more sort of alternative and interesting, but it's still kind of, she just tweets things like, you're such a dream to me, and gets like 35,000 retweets. And like, I think I love you.
I was asking around why, you know, what do her fan base, you know, the people who are driving her to become one of the biggest pop stars on the planet, what are they really interested in? Because some of them are so young. It really is about the journey and her accessibility and her relatability, as people like to say. So there is just a very human sort of pop princess side to it. But she does seem to be able to do some quite unusual, quirky, offbeat things as well. I mean, there's a song on, she's got this new boyfriend called Pete Davidson, who's a comedian, and there's a song called Pete Davidson on the album.
They're engaged, you know.
Who does that? Yeah. And it's really short. Yeah. It's like a joke. It's like, but it's wonderfully confident. It's like getting a tattoo of someone's name on your arm.
Yeah.
It's like, here's my song, Pete Davidson.
Talking of which, Pete Davidson, who I Googled the other day, has a tattoo of Hillary Clinton. Or is it just the words Hillary Clinton?
Oh, and she's massively Hillary as well. Ariana is.
When Hillary Clinton found out about this, she quipped. Well, that makes things less awkward because I've had a Pete Davidson tattoo for years. there are some jokes in here, and I just watched the video for God is a Woman, which is full of really, you know, over the top imagery of her sort of dancing in candle flames and, you know, lolling about naked in huge vats of paint. And then randomly about halfway through, it just cuts to a scene of a desert with little craters in it. And then these kind of Jim Henson type gopher puppets pop up out of the craters. One of them emits this sort of high-pitched gopher scream, and then they pop down again and disappears. It's never referred to again, has absolutely nothing to do with any other part of the video. So, you know, she's clearly having fun.
There's also a bit in that video where she's wearing like a skin suit, like a kind of beige skin suit to match her skin, but it's kind of got wrinkles in it. Yeah. So it's like Nora Batty's tights. Yes. And she's like trying to look sexy, but you can see these big wrinkles down the legs.
I didn't spot that.
Interesting. I don't know what her. Yeah, we were having a debate the other day about what category she fits into, A-list or B-list, in terms of the big pop divas of the world.
Right.
And there was a big kind of division around the table. This is what we talk about, as to where she, you know, people were saying there's no way she's in the Taylor Swift and Beyoncé camp, and I was saying she totally is because of what happened with Manchester. She's way up there in the clouds. Like the way she handled that was so perfect that she's kind of completely faultless, you know. So,
well, you refer to her as the Queen of Heaven.
I like to call her the Queen of Heaven. So in terms of that lift to take her onto that level where she may never have to do an interview again, then I kind of think she is up there.
Yeah.
And my friends were saying no, because no one really knows what her music's about. She hasn't had that many hits, and she appeals predominantly to children. So she's sort of in that funny transitional state at the moment.
There was, I don't know if you spotted this, but when she first started out, there was a sort of internet meme type thing saying, is Ariana Grande actually an adult baby?
Yeah.
But I think she's definitely got over that now.
And a big T-shirt came out last year that was quite popular, which was that I thought Ariana Grande was a font.
Really?
Yeah. That was the indie, that was the hipster joke about her name.
Sweetener, Ariana Grande's fourth album, is out now. And if you stream it on Spotify, you'll only add to its billion.
Just listen to the title track, because that's the best. That's the end of my review.
Sweetener.
Just listen to Sweetener.
Okay, there you go. Job done. It's a special moment today because we are here to celebrate the nonniversary of The Fugitive, which came out in August 1993. August the 6th, 1993, which makes it 25 years old.
Yay.
That is an actual number for once. Yeah. Well, not a round number, but a neat number.
25 rather than 15,
yeah,
which is what I would usually do.
Yeah,
I miss the 90s. Like,
yeah. Such a blur, man. if you remember it, didn't happen.
We both had very strong reactions to this film at the time, didn't we?
Yes, I nearly fainted. So I would have been just turned 12 a month before I went to see it. I don't know whether I was trying to look up whether it was a It must have been a 12
Well, we all
certificate,
went to see it. We were 12, weren't we? Like,
So it must have been a 12 certificate. It's based on this 60s TV series, which I've never seen.
Me too. Have you ever seen which it? I'm sure everyone says is the good one, so don't watch this. But yeah.
And it's Harrison Ford who is blamed for the murder of his wife and then goes on the run. But it you see the murder of his wife is shot in this incredibly intense style and with a lot of blood.
Mm.
And I'm quite squeamish. And somehow I just found this totally, it just knocked me for six. And I did eventually recover and managed to sit through the rest of the film, but it's a weirdly intense experience. You found that as well.
I found it in a different way. It was the first film I'd ever seen, which was, it felt like a grown-up film.
Yeah,
I was taken to the cinema by my mum and dad with my brother to see it, and it sounds really naff to say this, but I literally felt suddenly introduced to the fact that there was this amazing thing called cinema where you saw things happen that affected you. It wasn't like watching children's films, or it wasn't like watching my Indiana Jones, because I loved him. Like, he was one of my people as a child. But it was the sense of injustice in it, and the incredible moment at the end in the laundry room, this protracted scene in the laundry room where he's Harrison Ford still trying to hide from Tommy Lee Jones, and Jones won't give up the fight to get him, but of course he's realised that he's innocent through his own he's just realised that during the course of the investigation. And it was just one line. He just goes, "Richard, I know you're innocent." And I thought I was going to have a heart attack because of the relief of the idea that, and he's shouting it out over this laundry room, and there's this kind of this strange, I don't know, the settings of it were so there was such unity about it. There's the amazing scene with the dam at the beginning.
Yeah.
He jumps off that. There's the bus where he's got his orange kind of condemned suit and he's chained up to all these guys, and then he kind of flies off.
There's a tunnel, isn't there? Like an underground
tunnel.
Well, like a culvert. Yeah,
the one-armed man, the man with the... that was very chilling as well. This guy who's kind of, in a way, got quite a kind face, but he's got this very, very spooky prosthetic arm. And then obviously, as you say, the flashbacks to the murder of the wife. It was just so horrible, because I think she'd scattered rose petals up the stairs because she was going to have a romantic evening with him when he got home.
God,
and he comes back
that.
And he finds her like covered in blood
and
dying, not dead.
Oh, Jesus.
That was
so
the worst
traumatic.
Thing. She was still alive.
God, it's so traumatic.
And do you remember the scene with the subway where he realizes that the one-armed guy has seen him and like he tries to escape by walking up the subway and getting through all the, I don't know.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. But it's weirdly, for me, it's the, and I only realize this when I think about it, I think subconsciously it's the template for a lot of, when I watch these kind of Netflix true crime, that, you know, things now, this is sort of the template for it. The kind of the wrongfully imprisoned.
Oh,
you know,
gosh.
The wrongfully,
And of course he's a doctor. So do you remember the amazing scene where he goes into the hospital and treats himself? What a hero. He dresses up in some scrubs that he's nicked off someone. He goes in, stitches himself up, looks through his own medical records, and then like goes out and makes some.
I wonder if someone's written an essay or compiled a YouTube compilation of self-surgery in, because it is a trope. It happens in, so I was thinking about No Country for Old Men, because of course, the other great, you know, it's Tommy Lee Jones is the great cop character in The Fugitive, and also in No Country for Old Men, although in that one he plays kind of much more benevolent, you know, older man. But the villain in No Country for Old Men, there's an amazing scene in which he kind of sews up his own arm.
Yeah.
I'd forgotten that Harrison Ford does that so brilliantly in The Fugitive.
Yeah.
Does it stand up? Have you
rewatched
it?
Yeah, it really does. I've seen it like three or four times since the early 90s.
And probably better than those, because I love Harrison Ford too. I like everything he does. And this came in the middle of a run of 90s films, which I absolutely loved at the time. And I sort of haven't rewatched them because I suspect they're probably not very good.
Mm.
The other ones being Patriot Games and Clear and Present Danger.
I think it's free from the things that might date it sort of maybe politically in terms of, I just think it's kind of quite simple.
Yes.
So it doesn't have clunky like
racist bits in it that we'd kind of think now, oh my God, what are they doing
there?
And
it's not kind of tying in with a big sort of military industrial complex.
No.
You know, it's such a kind of focused story. Yeah.
And it was like, it did sort of introduce, it was the first introduction to me to kind of serious cinema, because within the same year, I then saw Philadelphia and Schindler's List. And I had to be carried down the steps after Philadelphia because I was so upset by that. It's like, you know, God, how are these things 12s? I know Schindler's List was a 15, but I swear Philadelphia was 12.
Yeah, you might be right.
And now, of course, everything's 15 and there are very few 18s. So
does 12 still exist?
I feel it doesn't really exist anymore. Maybe it does.
This was the great era of 12s.
12s that weren't really 12s.
Just briefly, we talked about Tommy Lee Jones' character who has this amazing speech of, you know, you got to search. We're going to search every outhouse, chicken house,
dog house,
Shake Shack, dog house. he was sort of such a hit that they, I only just discovered this today, they gave him a whole spin-off film with Wesley Snipes and Robert Downey Jr.
Wow.
So I'm going to track that down and watch it.
Was it well reviewed?
Probably bad. Mixed reviews.
What was it called?
Says, I will tell you in the next podcast. It's called something really straightforward, like Marshall. I think it might just be called Marshall.
And was it literally the same character?
Yeah.
I loved his clothes as well. I was such a sucker for that look on middle-aged men in the 90s. Jacket and jeans. They had stonewashed jeans and then they had like quite a boxy, like woolen navy coat.
I think we should probably stop this podcast. And I mean, we can just carry on talking about The Fugitive in our own time. Or maybe we should go and do some work. I don't know. But yes, happy 25th nonniversary to The Fugitive. Thank you for downloading this episode of The Back Half. We've been edited by Caroline Crampton and we'll be back in 2 weeks. Please do review us on iTunes, get in touch on Twitter and all the rest. And we will be playing you out with
a nice tune that we enjoy called Godspeed. You thought it was going to be a new one.
I thought you might have forgotten it after 4 weeks. Right?
No, I just decided not to do my anatomical reference anymore. A nice tune called Godspeed by Pistol Jazz.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50. Luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.